the civilian government that she has direct authority has been actually very much complicit in publishing inflammatory and dehumanizing articles against the Rohingya.
Rohingya repatriation to begin as Myanmar's de facto leader is stripped of an honor. It's Tuesday, November 13th. This is VOA Asia. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Hello. Join us on Facebook at VOA Asia. Also ahead, more South China Sea concerns, terror in Australia, Mumbai's slum kids reach up and out. It's all on today's VOA Asia. Leading international human rights group Amnesty International is stripping Myanmar leader Aung San Suu Kyi of its top honor over her failure to speak out or halt grave atrocities against her country's Rohingya Muslim population. VOA United Nations correspondent Margaret Bashir has more.
Amnesty awarded the former pro-democracy activist and longtime political prisoner its top honor in 2009. Amnesty's Asia-Pacific advocacy manager, Francisco Bencosme, told VOA his organization is deeply disappointed in Aung San Suu Kyi for not forcefully speaking out for the Rohingya and other minority groups in Myanmar.
We gave her the award in 2009, in part because we felt, and it was our expectation, that as an ambassador of conscience, she would continue to use her moral authority to speak out against injustice around the world, but in particular in Myanmar.
From 1989 to 2010, Myanmar's military-led government repeatedly confined Aung San Suu Kyi to house arrest. During that time, Western governments and human rights groups, including Amnesty, continuously advocated for her release. But since becoming the country's de facto civilian leader in April 2016, Aung San Suu Kyi and her administration have failed to condemn or try to stop atrocities perpetrated by the military against minority Rohingya residents in Rakhine State. More than 700,000 Rohingya fled the violence to neighboring Bangladesh, where survivors have given horrific accounts of violence. The United Nations has called the atrocities a textbook case of ethnic cleansing.
As we've seen with her own civilian government, they've been creating hostility against the Rohingya, labeling them as terrorists, accusing them of burning their own houses, and faking rape. So the state media, the civilian government that she has direct authority, has been actually very much complicit in publishing inflammatory and dehumanizing articles against the Rohingya.
Past recipients of Amnesty's Ambassador of Conscience Award include South Africa's Nelson Mandela, Pakistani education advocate Malala Yousafzai, and Chinese dissident Ai Weiwei. Margaret Bashir, VOA News, the United Nations.
A year after a bilateral agreement was signed, Myanmar is preparing to receive this week the first of thousands of Muslim Rohingya who fled a security crackdown last year for Bangladesh. An exodus of some 700,000 flowed into Bangladesh to escape violence in Myanmar's western Rakhine State in the wake of the crackdown after militants attacked security forces in August 2017. Myanmar said it is expecting the first of some 2,251 Rohingya to return beginning Thursday, followed by another 2,095. They are to be housed in transit camps and then another location where they will be housed and fed and given national verification cards. The Myanmar Social Welfare Relief and Resettlement Minister, Win Myat Aye, said the repatriation is dependent on Bangladesh as to whether it takes place. Bangladesh insisted any repatriation will be voluntary and no one will be forced to return. Vikram Nehru, a distinguished practitioner in residence at the Johns Hopkins University, tells VOA's Victor Beatty he remains skeptical this effort will even take place.
Because while the Myanmar authorities may have announced that they are ready to receive, you know, several thousand Rohingya refugees, first of all, it's not clear whether the refugees themselves feel safe enough to return home. And secondly, I think as far as the international community is concerned, a precondition for the return of the refugees should be some international oversight to ensure the security of these refugees once they return. After all, these refugees would be returning to an environment which has been traditionally extremely hostile to them, where they've had no security of person, no security of rights of any kind, no security for their property, and no economic security. And unfortunately, this hostility has occurred in the central government, in the military, amongst the police force, by the state government and by civil society groups, especially the militant Buddhist groups in Myanmar. So unless there are guarantees for their security underwritten by the international community, I'm not sure whether there would be many Rohingyas willing to go back and risk their life and limb on the basis of a promise by the Myanmar authorities.
In fact, the UN and some rights groups say conditions are not yet safe for their return.
The history of antagonism and violence towards the Rohingyas by the mainstream Bamar groups as well as by the government is a long one. It's a history that goes back decades, if not even centuries. So the reality is that if these Rohingyas are to go back, they really should go back with some international guarantee for their safety.
A statement by the UN High Commissioner for Refugees called on the Myanmar government to allow refugees to go and see for themselves the conditions that will greet them before making an independent assessment about whether to return. These are among some of the top Asia stories that you'll find right now on VOAnews.com. Amnesty International strips Aung San Suu Kyi of honor over Rohingya abuses. Meth seizures up in Myanmar and across Southeast Asia. Indonesian migrant workers remain vulnerable, activists say. Expanded coverage of these stories and much more can be found on Facebook. You can also visit our VOAnews.com website. VOA Asia continues. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Ahead of the U.S.-ASEAN summit in mid-November, Southeast Asian nations have expressed concerns about mounting tensions between Washington and Beijing. They point out to the U.S. Sino-tariff war, increasingly aggressive rhetoric from both governments, and a recent incident involving the two countries' warships. White House correspondent Patsy Wittikaswara has more.
In September, the U.S. Navy destroyer, the USS Decatur, had a close call with a Chinese warship. The Luoyang came within 40 meters of the American vessel's bow, prompting it to maneuver to prevent a collision. The incident near a Chinese-claimed reef in the South China Sea added to tensions between Washington and Beijing.
Despite such reckless harassment, the United States Navy will continue to fly, sail, and operate wherever international law allows and our national interests demand. We will not be intimidated, and we will not stand down.
China has expanded its control over much of the South China Sea in recent years, building military bases and airstrips on tiny islands and reefs. The United States and its allies have responded with freedom of navigation exercises near Beijing's disputed claims to ensure that China does not block sea and air traffic. China challenges these exercises.
Recently, there have been similar incidents with a British warship. There have been incidents with others. And in response, not just the United States, but Australia, the United Kingdom, and other countries have all said they plan to continue sailing through these waters and just putting up with the Chinese, what they would call Chinese harassment.
So far, the Chinese and American military leadership are still communicating, which indicates neither country wants confrontation.
To ease tensions in the South China Sea, China and ASEAN member states conducted their first joint maritime exercises last month. ASEAN is also preparing for similar exercises with the United States for the first time next year. Patsy Wittikaswara, VOA News, at the White House.
Australian investigators say a Somali-born man who stabbed bystanders in the center of Melbourne on Friday had been inspired and radicalized by the militant group calling itself Islamic State. As we reported yesterday, Hassan Khalif Shire Ali was shot by police and later died in a hospital. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
Somali-born migrant Hassan Khalif Shire Ali crashed his car that was packed with gas bottles in the heart of Australia's second biggest city. He stabbed three people. A 74-year-old restaurant owner died at the scene, and two other people are being treated in hospital. Neither are in a serious condition. Authorities say Shire Ali had previously had his Australian passport cancelled due to fears he planned to travel to Syria in 2015. Despite being known to hold radical views, he was not being actively monitored by Australian security agencies and had been assessed as not posing a threat to the community. It's thought the attacker moved to Australia from Somalia in the 1990s and that members of his family had been known to police on terrorism-related matters. Victoria State's Chief Police Commissioner is Graham Ashton.
In relation to that person, he is known to police, mainly in respect to relatives that he has that are certainly persons of interest to us. For operational reasons, we now have the Counter-Terrorism Command and the Homicide Squad dealing with this matter, and there are ongoing investigations being conducted by the Counter-Terrorism Command.
Australian Prime Minister Scott Morrison said extreme Islam is one of the greatest threats to his country. Officials say Australia's terror threat level would remain at probable. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Coming up, rising above poverty in Mumbai. You're listening to VOA Asia. This news from VOA Asia. U.S. Vice President Mike Pence arrived in Tokyo to discuss North Korea and other issues with Japanese officials before heading to two regional summits. Pence is also discussing China's growing regional influence and bilateral trade with Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe, according to officials. You can visit VOA Asia Facebook each day for top stories and great features. This is VOA Asia. As VOA Asia continues, in the heart of India's financial capital, Mumbai, lies one of the largest slums in the world. A group of underprivileged children from there is making their bridge to the world outside their slum. And by using one of the most common items in their modest homes, the children create beautiful sounds. VOA's Rital Joshi reports from Mumbai.
Dharavi, known as the largest slum in Asia. In this maze of narrow alleys that form the underbelly of India's financial capital, Mumbai, even sunlight is scarce. But not all alleys lead to darkness. At the end of this dingy lane, a narrow staircase leads many children to a shining horizon that offers learning and opportunity. A non-profit group called Acorn Foundation has been working with children here for 10 years.
We have to create ways for them to leave the slums of Dharavi. They should feel that they have a chance to lead better lives.
In 2008, Acorn Foundation came up with a way to channel the children's creative energy by using recycled plastic drums to create music. Soon, Dharavi Rocks was born. Impressed with the initiative, many musicians joined in to help train the children.
Every kid can play on this equipment in their own home. So what we use to play music will not cost them anything because they can find this at home. These buckets and drums is where we started this whole thing.
Dharavi Rocks has put on over 150 performances so far across India and even in London. Some members have landed roles in Hindi films. Ritul Joshi, VOA News, Mumbai, India.
Friend indeed, whether human or robot. I'm Faith Lapidus, VOA News.
You've been listening to VOA Asia. You can find our program in many different places, online, like iTunes and SoundCloud. You can follow us every day on VOA Asia Facebook as we stream our program, and check out some of the other stories we post each and every day there as well. We're also on our website, voanews.com, and you can find our entire full-length programs there, also programs from previous days if you happen to miss one and want to check it out. It's all right there at voanews.com. We're also found on the radio. Many great radio stations across Asia carry our program, like CCU Radio at National Chungcheng University in Taipei, Taiwan. Thanks to everyone there who tuned in today. And our thanks always go to Director Tracy Carter, Engineer Dan Crafton, Managing Editor Diane Gao, and our VOA Asia team. That's Skylar Ogden, Ira Melman, Doug Bernard, Keith Lane, and Anna Cook. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're in Washington. We hope you have a great day ahead.